Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Thomas Howard. Thomas has been a professor of English and literature for over 30 years. He's the author of numerous popular books, including Chance or the Dance, On Being Catholic, Lead Kindly Light, and Evangelical Is Not Enough. He's considered one of the best authorities on the fiction of C.S. Lewis. We're going inside the pages of Narnia and Beyond, a guide to the fiction of C.S. Lewis, published by Ignatius Press. Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today.
Quite delighted to be with you. I always love talking about Lewis.
What do you suppose it was about Lewis that the things that occurred in his life that would influence him in writing the Narnia Chronicles?
Oh, that's a good question, and it goes pretty much right to the bullseye of Lewis's life. He and his brother grew up in their father's household. Their mother died when they were young in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and Lewis and his brother Warnie were alone a lot. They both loved books, and luckily their father, it was a big house, and their father had shelves and shelves of books all the way up and down the house through the attic corridors and so on. And they read those books, but they also loved to write their own little stories, Lewis and his brother. And they began writing stories about a land they called Boxen. And it was populated by talking animals. And for some reason, that's the direction their imagination took. And they loved that. And then when Lewis went off to school, like all English boys, he was sent away to boarding school, to Malvern College they call it college, we would call it school. Somewhere along in there, he was kind of awakened to something that he called in his later works, Sehnsucht, the German word. We don't have an exact word in English for it, but Lewis describes it as that inconsolable yearning that we all have at the center of our being. Of course, he, being a Christian, would understand that, as would all Catholics, as our yearning for God, the one from whom we were made and for whom we were made. And Lewis's notion was that all the most exquisite beauties on this earth where we live are little hints or reflections or reminders of the real beauty. So that he felt that, you know, the beauty of a wonderful landscape. He loved walking in his brother in the Cotswolds, which is a lovely little hill country of England, and in the Highlands of Scotland. He felt that the pleasure you feel there is an odd one, because in a sense you love the morning in the sunlit hills in the Cotswolds, but somehow or other something tugs at your heart. And you think, oh, I wish I could get into this or something. And Lewis really felt quite strongly that that was the God himself wooing us with these lesser beauties and drawing us on to the real thing, of which these are just little dim foretastes. And he felt the same way about the beautiful music. You hear a Mozart horn concerto or something, and it's both a pleasure and kind of arouses a yearning in you for something. And what is that something? And so this very much crops up in Lewis's imaginative works, his children's books and so on, this sense of the yearning for something which is, as he called it in Narnia, farther up and farther in.
It's interesting that someone who is a scholar in medieval and Renaissance literature would develop this type of fantasy.
Well, it is. It's interesting, and in a sense, it makes sense, because of course the Middle Ages and the Renaissance are absolutely chock full of once upon a time type stories.
Right.
And also, Lewis loved the Greek myths, but he especially loved the Norse myths from Scandinavia. He, as a matter of fact, he even gives it a name. He calls it Northernness. And there was something that really tugged at his heartstrings about those wonderful stories of Siegfried and the gods in the Norse mythology. And, of course, all of the Middle Ages are full of that sort of thing. And then the stories that the late Middle Ages called romances, you know, about knights going through the woods and all that sort of thing. But Lewis loved the formula, you know, once upon a time in a far-off kingdom there lived a king. And he felt that, of course, he was a good scholar of all that sort of thing, but he never lost almost, you might say, that childlike wonder and awe in the presence of stories like this. And of course, he was lucky because his subject matter, namely medieval and Renaissance literature, was an absolute fountainhead of those sorts of stories.
Thomas, we were talking about Lewis's love of mythology from all the different ages. He would go on after the war to teach at Oxford, where he would meet a man by the name of Tolkien, who helped him to see myth in a different light.
Absolutely, yes. Tolkien, of course, had for years and years before he and Lewis met, had been head over heels in the same northern myths that Lewis loved. And of course, we all know Tolkien now as the author of the marvelous saga of Frodo and the Lord of the Rings and
right. mm-hmm.
all of that. And they met and just instantly, you know, they knew that they were soulmates, I suppose our decade would call them.
Mm-hmm.
And what bothered Lewis, because he was a proud, bristling young atheist, all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and these people, Tolkien and several other friends, who were clearly dazzling intellects, they were dons, professors at Oxford, and the thing that really got under Lewis's skin was that they were believing Christians. He'd always given himself the luxury of thinking, well, Christianity is for nice ladies over the teacups in the provinces.
Mm-hmm.
We grown-up intellects here at Oxford, of course, we know better than all about that God rubbish. And here's Tolkien, who was his favorite person, who was an absolute card-carrying Roman Catholic believer.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of other men like that, Lord David Cecil and several others. And Lewis, they were not hesitant about piping up about their Christian faith, and they had, of course, thousands of hours of conversation. And when Lewis finally knuckled under and became a believer, he claimed, he said, you know, he was argued into the Christian faith. His intellect had to crumple in front of the evidence before his heart was really converted. And he said that, you know, he was first converted to theism, namely, he was forced to acknowledge that there was a God, but he, you know, didn't buy the whole Christian thing yet. He was riding on the top of a bus, and somehow, just while he was riding, the penny dropped that there is a God. And he said, I went back to my room in Magdalen College, Oxford, and got down on my knees and acknowledged that God was God. I was the unhappiest convert in all things. I was the last person he wanted to meet. And then it was about a year later that he was riding in the sidecar of his brother's motorcycle. And he said, when we started out, they were going to a zoo, Whipsnade Zoo. He said, when we started out, I did not believe that Christ was the Son of God. When we got to the zoo, I did. It was Tolkien and others who had really drawn him into Christian belief.
Do you think he meant to try to break open people's different conception of God with his writings of the Chronicles?
Oh, I think so. Yes, and as a matter of fact, he, of course, first of all, when he was converted in the 1930s, he didn't know quite what to do next as a Christian. And he thought, well, I guess I better go to church. So he started doing that again. He went to Magdalen College Chapel. He said, well, at least you ought to fly your flag. So
right.
He went to morning prayers at the Magdalen College Chapel, much to everybody's delight and chagrin. I mean, they thought, oh, what's happened to poor old Lewis? You know, he's gone soft in the head and become a Christian. But then, yeah, then he wrote his famous defenses of the Christian faith, Mere Christianity,
right.
and other books like that, and lots of essays and speeches. But then he began writing these once upon a time type things, both adult fiction, kind of mythic type stories in the 1940s, and then the Narnia Chronicles in the early 50s. And he felt that fairy tales were a wonderful way to kind of as you say, break open people's notions about God and so on. Because I went to see him one time, and he told me, he said, you know, your defenses are down when you hear Once Upon a Time. If you go to hear an evangelist or a preacher, your defenses are up. You know, it's religion, and, you know, maybe I don't believe in religion or something, but you sit down with a book, and Once Upon a Time in a Far-Off Land, you know, where Lucy stumbles through a wardrobe into a fairyland, your defenses are down, and you're drawn in. And Lewis, you know, there is very little that's explicitly Christian in the Narnia Chronicles, although for any Christian, it's very thinly veiled. I mean, Aslan is the son of the emperor beyond the sea, and he gives his life as a sacrifice for the deliverance of Narnia from the power of the Wicked Witch. Mm-hmm. So, you know, any Catholic can see the whole gospel just glimmering through these stories. But the nice thing is they're more than just sugarcoating on a religious pill. Mm-hmm. They're real, wonderful, delightful, thrilling fairy tales that can stand on their own two feet as fairy tales. They're almost irresistible.
And the thing is, it's not just The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It's the whole chronicle setting.
Yes.
That is so compelling because you get to see what will become the seven friends of Narnia.
Yes.
What do you suppose the significance was when you hear the number seven?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much symbolism in this whole Chronicles. It's incredible.
Of course, and there were seven books.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, I think Lewis, like any Christian, would have, you know, as a kind of a backdrop of his imagination, all the Christian ideas and Christian symbols and Christian imagery. And, of course, seven seems to be through the whole Bible and in the church kind of the number of perfection. It's always been generally agreed that it somehow or other the number seven represents, along with three of the Holy Trinity, represents the number of perfection. So I think, you know, his seven friends of Narnia, rather than six or eight or something, even though all numbers are sort of significant to Christians, but I think it just kind of makes sense that he wanted to lodge in our minds the seven friends of Narnia as, you know, any, and I think it was a nice way to put it, because as any Christian living in this world, when we, you know, we haven't got farther up and farther in yet into the real Narnia, but we are friends of Narnia. We, you know, in an alien world and in a world which is still under the grip, you might say, of the White Witch, we are the Christians are the friends of Narnia. Lewis would certainly have felt of himself that way and of all of his fellow believers.
And the thing is, I think we all have a little bit of Lucy and a little bit of Edmund in all of us.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think that's part of the genius of the Chronicles. Here's Lucy, you know, she's a little girl and has the natural curiosity and naivety and, as it turns out in Lucy's case, goodwill of a little girl like that. And, you know, one can identify with her, but I'm afraid a lot of us, particularly I'm afraid us men, have to bow our heads in shame and admit that we've got a lot in common with Edmund and with Eustace Clarence Scrub in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, you know, who were, they were little boys and they were redeemable, thank Aslan, thank heaven, but they had some pretty heavy-duty lessons to learn before they became friends of Narnia.
As we look at the story, I mean, Lucy is always the one who is being called to go take that next step. I mean, to believe in something that it doesn't seem believable.
Well, that, of course, you put your finger right on one of the major themes in all of C.S. Lewis's works, adult and the children fiction. Namely, he felt profoundly that woman... is the mystery of femininity has something to do with this openness to God. And it went in various directions for Lewis. I mean, obviously, as a good Anglican, he never became a Roman Catholic. But, of course, he would have seen the Blessed Mother as though she was a woman. Mm-hmm. She was the one of us mortals who said to the approaches of the divine, be it done unto me according to thy word, behold the handmaid of the Lord. You know, the rest of us spend our whole lives struggling to get toward the grace to say, behold the handmaid of the Lord in our own lives. He saw, and Lucy, so obviously being a woman, she knows in her bones and marrow, or she's open and attuned to the voice of Aslan, or the notion that Aslan is on the move. And she's always the first one to be aware of that. And usually it is the feminine characters in his books, even in his adult books, that are that represent that. And I think Lewis, who had the most somber misgivings about the feminist doctrines that came along, although he was dead before it kind of exploded onto the public stage. But way back when, he felt it was a travesty for women to try to somehow or other to establish their identity and their validity and struggle for equality with men by aping men, by becoming EOs and getting an attaché case and getting power. He felt that that was all belonged to the power struggle, and that the reason men have been the philosophers and composers of music and the world explorers and the conquerors of kingdoms and all that is because the men are restless. They're charging around the outskirts and creating philosophy and symphonies and conquering kingdoms. And the women are not as driven as men, because they're already there. They're at the center. The man seeks the woman in marriage, and she knows something. And I think any married man knows that, you know, his wife somehow or other knows in her bones and marrow what the man kind of struggles with cerebrally. At least this is what I think Lewis profoundly believed, and that's why you get characters like Lucy.
I don't want to spoil it for anybody who is beginning to enter into the Chronicles, but I think as you go down the road, you'll see some of the ramifications in that in the character of Susan.
Absolutely, yes. And Susan, alas, she got worldly, so to speak, and was siphoned off by what T.S. Eliot in his poetry would call distracted by distraction from distraction. And she eventually was estranged from the Friends of Narnia because she had kind of been looking over the fence and wanting to be like everybody else. And she got worldly. Mm-hmm. To that extent, you know, her vision was dimmed, and it was a great pity. And I think also the figures of the witches, they're interesting characters. There's at least three, and one of the characters, one of the good guys in Narnia, says, I wonder if all these witches are the same witch. The White Witch in The Lion, the Witch in the Wardrobe, and the Green Lady in The Silver Chair, and Jadis, the witch in Magician's Nephew. They are all kind of figures of a very strange character that goes back into ancient mythology named Lilith. She appears in Jewish lore as Adam's first wife. She's not in the Bible.
Right.
And the idea was that Lilith got dissatisfied with being a wife, a spouse, and kind of predestined to bear children and be domestic and all this sort of thing. And she left Adam and left Eden and went out into the wilderness, and she became the ancestor of all wicked stepmothers and wicked fairy godmothers who stick pins into princesses in their cradles.
Oh, pleasant woman.
Sorceresses. She hates life. She hates domesticity. She hates fruitfulness, and therefore, of course, hates childbearing and family, and hates men, too. And I think in Narnia particularly, and of course, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the witch has got Narnia in a sterile bondage. It's always winter and never Christmas.
Right.
And her wand can only turn happy little creatures who are obviously good, and they're Aslan's creatures, she turns them to stone. She hates seeing them having a picnic. She loathes that, and Lilith loathes the creation.
And it's interesting that the animals do her bidding out of fear.
Yes.
I'm thinking of Pope John Paul always exhorting us to be not afraid.
Oh, yes. I mean, he rang the bell with that. And, of course, I suppose one of the worst chains that the enemy, the devil, puts on us is the bondage of fear. And you can see it in little Mr. Tumnus, the fawn, toward the
right.
beginning of the... You know, he thought... He was petrified of the witch and therefore, you know, agreed sort of to become a spy and an abductor for her, but his goodness overcame that. He couldn't last. And even though he was terrified what might happen to him, the witch, he just had to break down and cry and tell Lucy, oh, I'm a terrible, terrible person, mm-hmm. you know. I've been sent as a spy, you know, I'm supposed to take you prisoner, but he couldn't do it.
Right.
But he was terrified of the witch.
It's very compelling in the Chronicles, as folks will begin to become aware of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. As we follow these characters throughout the Chronicles, what happens with Edmund and his relationship also with Anselm, especially in the next book following this one?
Yes.
Can you speak to that a little bit about Edmund?
Oh, yes. Well, Edmund's a wonderful character because, like us sinful mortals, but I think, you know, men have a lot of Edmund's characteristics. He, of course, is he's kind of an objectionable little boy. I mean, even when you're, before Lucy has gotten into Narnia, Edmund seems a kind of a peevish little boy and all of that. And I think even there we've got Lewis drawing on something that's very big, namely things that might be, we might dismiss them as, oh, well, he's just an irritable little boy or something. But as Lewis says in many of his other works, everything is always thickening and hardening and coming to a point. And Edmund's irritability and his, you know, slightly malicious little boy bad temper, and he just seems to be like to cross everybody, that thickens and hardens and comes to the point where he shows up basically as Judas Iscariot. I mean, mm-hmm. he betrays everybody. But then, of course, he is redeemed by Aslan. There's a wonderful scene before Aslan's sacrifice when he gives himself to the power of the White Witch. And Edmund and Aslan are seen walking off together, and somebody, one of the other children, later on asks Aslan, what were you talking to Edmund about? And Aslan says, that's not part of your story. What mm-hmm. happened between Edmund and me is between Edmund and me. And it's just very much like the seal of the confessional. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are stories that are mine alone, and only God and I know those stories. And, of course, then Edmund becomes a wonderful character and as mm-hmm. true as gold. But and I think it's Edmund, unless it's Eustace, who's another bad little boy who gets redeemed. One of the characters, a newcomer, says, oh, do you know Aslan? And if it's Edmund, he says, well, he knows me. Mm. I think that's a wonderful thing. And there again, Lewis puts his finger on something that's very true about us and God in our world. Well, I don't know how well I know God, but he knows me.
I think what's stunning, too, is how Lewis, in this wonderful story, in this whole chronicle, gives us a sense of how time works.
Oh, yes.
And how it's so transcendent.
Yes, yes. There's a sense in which, you know, Aslan is on the move. Aslan has got he knows that he will overcome the White Witch and so on, but his followers, the children, have to be drawn through the time process. Aslan doesn't just wave a wand and overcome the White Witch and defeat her and restore Narnia to springtime and all the little animals to their flesh and blood again. The children are involved in that, you know, and I think that's very much the Catholic idea of grace, that grace doesn't just magically do things over our heads. It draws us into the real process. We have to walk through time, and yet we are walking through the purposes of of Aslan, or in our story of God and Jesus Christ. And Aslan, in a sense, Aslan, even though he's all-powerful, he waits for the consent of the characters. When Peter has to go in, I mean, Aslan could easily have just, you know, roared and won the fight with the White Witch, but Peter has to take his sword and go into the battle. And somebody says, oh, help, help, you know, what'll happen to Peter? And Aslan says, let the prince win his spurs. You know, God, the more you read the books, the more I used to say to my students, when I was teaching these, you know, you forget that they're fairy tales, and you say to yourself, you know, I'm reading a true story. I'm reading a true story. This is exactly like our story, which, of course, would have made Lewis very happy.
That's right. Well, and the thing is, I love the glimpse towards later in the Chronicles where some of the friends actually have a glimpse of Aslan's world, and yet they can't. And isn't it Lucy that cries and is crying, and people are asking why she's so sad? She's not sad.
Yes, that's right. She's and I mean, there's no question the glimpses we have of joy and glory in the Narnia Chronicles are beyond anything that I know of in all of literature. I mean, that final rush up into Aslan's country at the end of the last battle with Jewel the unicorn leading the way, and Reepy Cheep there with his little red plume greeting them at the gate, you know, and farther up and farther. I mean, there's this wonderful sense of this rush up into the thing of which everything else has been kind of foreshadowings. Even Narnia itself, which to the children is just wonderful beyond words, is itself a foretaste of the real Narnia, of Aslan's own country.
Would it be safe to say that you would recommend this not only for children, but for adults to grow in their faith life?
Any adult, I would say drop everything and read it.
And we'll hope you will maybe come back again and help break open some other things for us as we continue on our journey on this chronicle of our lives.
Well, thank you. You're a very good host. It's been my pleasure.
You're one of a great gifts to our church.
Well, thank you. God bless you.
We've been going inside the pages of Narnia and Beyond, a guide to the fiction of C.S. Lewis with Thomas Howard. Thomas's book can be found at Ignatius.com, the website for Ignatius Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and download this discussion along with many others, go to www.insidethepages.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.